Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Aging is unknown territory with no map. These are the words of author Kamala Kapoor. She was born and raised in India and studied in the United States. She is an award-winning playwright, poet, and author of 8 books. Kamala Kapoor is a retired college literature professor who has written a book about savoring the fullness of life. The title of her book is The Privilege of Aging. Kamala Kapoor, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Nancy.
The title of your book says The Privilege of Aging. Do people say, Kamala, do you think aging is a privilege? How do you explain that?
Well, you know, I talk about that because it's very important when you're talking about aging is to talk about the downsides also. Mm-hmm. And there are downsides, and anything that doesn't admit that would not be doing justice to the process of aging. But as I've written in my preface, it's, you know, you can focus on aging sucks, or you can focus on aging as a privilege. And the reason why I see it as a privilege is because I have had experience of the many ways in which aging is a privilege. I focus on the privilege. If I were to focus on the downsides of aging, I've just had been diagnosed with 3 autoimmune diseases and have been through a very bad phase health-wise. But actually, I must admit that through the whole process, I focused on the gift in the illness. And there were many gifts in the illness that I focused on. And it ended up being, I'm a little bit out of the dark phase of it and the debilitated phase of it. And I continue to see it, all the things that I learned through this illness, as privileges.
Well, since you mentioned your preface, I would like to read a couple of paragraphs. There's a little short section in your preface that you talked about one of the greatest gifts of aging. And I identified with so much in your book that when you were saying these words, there were so many things that you said in your book. I thought, oh, I want to remember that. I found your book so quotable. But would you read a little bit from your preface about one of the greatest gifts of aging?
Yes, definitely. One of the greatest gifts of aging is slowing down the pace. It allows us to experience and taste life fully with awareness, attention, senses, and mind awake. For this, we need time. And we have it. Hallelujah. Going slowly is also imperative to avoid injuries and accidents. I know many who have injured themselves in hurried or inattentive moments, in some cases with repercussions for years. I know the joys of slowing down. Foremost among them, doing just one thing at a time and doing it with attention. Though I am aware my time is limited, I know that whatever I complete will be enough. Whatever I leave undone is also fine.
My guest is Kamala Kapoor, and she's reading from her preface to her book, The Privilege of Aging, Savoring the Fullness of Life. And you mentioned slowing down is one of the gifts of growing older. And you also, it comes across, too, that you gain wisdom as you grow older. And so often I think, it's a good thing I lived as long as I did because I've learned so much in these years. And you mentioned in your book that you read The New Yorker.
Yes.
And so you probably, a couple of years ago, there was an article that raised the question, are you the same person you were when you were a child? So I'm going to ask you that question. Because you mentioned in your book how you were. You say, I wasn't very kind to myself in my youth.
Yes. No, I wouldn't say I'm the same person, although my core remains the same. I have over the years, I think that I know I'm not the same person because I negotiated life differently when I was young, and all the things that I've learned in the subsequent years helped me to be a happier person. I would definitely say that I'm a happier person now than I was. Even a year ago, because even in a year, one learns so much. It's like, that wonderful quote by James Hillman. He says, aging is no accident. It is necessary to the human condition, intended by the soul. So aging is a very important part of our journey, because we accomplish things in aging that we cannot or do not or unable to learn when we are younger.
Well, I thought perhaps you might mention the word procrastination, because in my entire life, I have never been a procrastinator, but I've been trying to cultivate procrastination now in my later years. And that brings up the fact that you, often in your book, you say doing nothing has been and continues to be one of the most difficult endeavors of my life. And you say, perhaps because I'm still trying to define and clarify the concept of myself. And you say that doing nothing is an ongoing practice that takes a lifetime to master. I can vouch for that, I think. You say, doing nothing is an imperative, an absolute must as we age. I know. So how are you doing in this practice you're cultivating of doing nothing?
Well, I have to tell you that the illness that I mentioned earlier really helped me to move into the moment. And when you're in the moment, you are very aware of your body and your need to do nothing, to rest. Now, I mentioned that it's difficult because we are so conditioned to doing, and we think that unless we are doing, we are not worthwhile.
We're not productive. We need to be productive, Kamala.
Yeah, exactly.
that's what I always, the burden I put on myself, I need to be doing. I can't do nothing. I've got to be productive. I've got to be accomplishing something. And it's been very hard for me, just like you're saying, that doing nothing is hard for you. But one thing that I've taken to heart is an Italian expression, dolce far niente. Dolce is sweet. And at one point you say in your preface, you say, side by side with activity, as I age, I have become better at wasting time. Not hurrying, going slowly, doing nothing, resting as frequently as I need. And I love that list, but the one thing that I wonder about is you say, I've become better at wasting time. And that's why that Italian expression I feel is sweet. Dolce far niente. It's sweet to do nothing.
you have to turn your definitions around and see doing nothing as productive. Mm-hmm. Because doing nothing is not a passive activity. It is an active engagement with doing nothing. I'm going to do nothing for the next 10 minutes. And you find you open up a space in that time to go on to the next thing, whatever the most optimal next thing might be. So
one day in a yoga class, that was kind of the theme for my yoga class. When you're doing a yoga pose, you're being, not doing. And after class, a woman came up and said that she had just read in Time magazine an article entitled, "Do Less, It's Good for You. Unproductive moments can boost health and happiness."
Yes.
So what you're encouraging your readers to do is good for their health, Kamala.
It's good for everything. It's good for your psyche. It's good for your health. It's good for your state of mind. It's good for your happiness. As a culture, we really have no idea, and we pay no focus to all the finer qualities of life, which, you know, produce nothing except well-being,
Well, the article in Time magazine says, relaxing may sound like the easiest thing in the world, but for many people, it's anything but. And that's kind of a shame. So is that one of the reasons you wrote your book? Well, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I was getting older, and I was having trouble negotiating it. And whenever I'm faced with a sort of a node in my life or a difficult period in my life, I end up writing about it, because writing clarifies so much. Writing engages you with the topic and makes you discover it. It's a journey of self-discovery, you know. So I decided I would write about my aging, and I discovered so many valuable lessons while I was writing it.
Let me remind listeners that my guest is Kamala Kapoor. The title of her book is The Privilege of Aging, Savoring the Fullness of Life. And I think you inspire, speaking as a reader myself, that I think you inspire us to see, in your words, see another way of thinking and being. Because we don't hear, I don't think, too many people telling us what you're saying, maybe more now, but I think you can help readers see another way of thinking and being.
Well, that's what my intention was, you know, that like one of the quotes, one of the one sentence quotes from my books is, our task is to clean and upgrade the lens through which we see the world. For example, we were just talking about doing nothing. And if we're looking at the world through the eyes of being productive all the time, then we are sabotaging our peace, you know. So our minds, which can both imprison and, when conquered, liberate us to lead more meaningful, engaged, purposeful lives. So I talk a lot about how it is the mind, you know, like in William Blake's quote about, or maybe it's Milton, the mind is its own place and makes its own heaven and its own hell. And we do, by our unchecked minds, by letting them go every which way into despair and depression and negative thinking, we sabotage ourselves, we hurt ourselves, we don't allow ourselves our fullness of being alive in this life, which is such a gift.
I think you just said a key word. You said, Lara says, being. We think of doing, but not just being. Well, since you mentioned a quote, how about just telling listeners in generally how you structured your book? We might expect quotes from poets, from a lit teacher.
Yes, there are those. But, you know, when I structured my book, I have to tell you that a lot of my readers tell me that, who have read this book, is that the structure is the structure of a river as it flows. So it makes sense. It is coherent, but it flows, and flow matters a great deal to me as a writer. So if you want to know how I went about doing that, first and foremost, when I decided I would write this book, I really believe in the power of journaling to generate material. And so I did that. And then, of course, I have to go back and structure the journal, the journal essays, and add stories and add my own story and tell the truth about myself as honestly as I can, because I don't like books that tell us what to do, you know.
Well, you said your husband doesn't like to be told what to do.
Yeah. And I do the same with him, and that's one of the lessons we learn.
Yeah. Yeah. You know. My guest is Kamala Kapoor. She has written a book, The Privilege of Aging. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Kamala Kapoor, who has written a book about the privilege of aging. You say something in your book that, man, is it ever true now? You say, "I'm aware of the tentativeness of all plans." And this just comes up daily. So last Friday, I thought I was getting together with a friend who's he phoned me and said, well, I got up from meditation and this longtime friend of mine just fell over and I'm at the hospital right now. I had to take her to the hospital, and there I thought my day was going to be a nice visit with a friend, and he certainly had no idea that he was going to be taking a friend to the hospital. So all our plans now are tentative, and I think that helps that you remind us of that.
Sure, you have to be flexible in life. Because, you know, flexible and resilient and flow with what happens. And that's what I meant with the moment. You know, you can get interrupted. One day my husband was having chest pains and we had to rush to the emergency when, you know, you have to be flexible. You have to flow with it.
Well, that's a joke that often people say about me, about being flexible. I mean, I teach yoga. They say, yes, you have to be flexible. Now, you mentioned your yoga practice, and you yes. also mentioned the role of friendships. And for me, I combine those two, that you say friendships and social connections play a role in overall well-being. And I get together with some friends that we get together and practice. We often go a long time before we even say a word, unless there's somebody new, but we practice our yoga together. And so I found that that was helpful. Now, you do your yoga on your own, and I certainly understand that, because you can adapt it. But
I do most things on my own. I'm a solitary, but I do believe in the power of friendships, and I do have some very good friends. And you know, one of the things that yoga does is keeps you physically flexible, so you can and you can apply that to your mind as well, and keep your mind flexible as well. And one aids the other. The body aids the mind, and the mind aids the body. You know.
And you also mentioned listening to your body, and that's one of the main things that yoga encourages you to do. And do you find that people? Well, what do you mean, Kamala? Listen to your body.
Yes, and that is also a lifetime practice. You know, generally we treat our bodies like beasts of burdens. We override them with our minds. You know, the mind says, "Do this right now." The mind says, "Do that right now." The mind is an autocrat, and you know, and
mine was a dictator for years.
A dictator. It's a fascist. You know.
Well, I might remind people that the advice you're offering is not because you're an MD. So why should people take your word for things, Kamala?
Because I've experienced them. What more proof can you have than empirical proof? You know, I give examples from my own life, and they're very detailed. They're very sometimes revealing stories about myself that I hope I offer myself as proof of what I say, you know.
Well, I can certainly see that coming through, because you're, so many ways, your background is completely different from mine, but in so many ways, what you say, I've experienced too. So I don't have any problem believing the things that you say in your book. Although there is one thing, and I have a question for you, because I always wonder, when I was studying the Bhagavad Gita, this hero, this nice guy, is being told to go kill his relatives. And you sometimes use the word warrior, and you say in your book, "I need to become a warrior." And I think, gosh, a warrior? And I know the hero in the Bhagavad Gita, it's his duty as a warrior. But how do you mean, why would you say you need to become a warrior, Kamala?
Well, what are some of the traits of a warrior? When you think about a warrior, you think about courage, you think about fearlessness, you think about since you brought up, you know, the advice of Krishna to Arjuna, mm-hmm. kill your relatives, you know. What does that mean in modern day? You don't literally go and kill your relatives, but or people who you love. But you don't always follow them. You stay true to yourself. And that's what warriors do. Warriors, you know, they plow through all obstacles to their fulfillment as whole human beings. We're not talking about literal warriors. We're talking about metaphoric warriors. For example, warriors situate themselves squarely within themselves and follow their own dictates instead of the dictates of society, for example, of culture or clan or tribe. You know, warriors think for themselves, warriors act for themselves. So that is what I mean by a warrior. And of course, if you start talking about warriors, you could write a whole book on what it takes to be a warrior.
My guest is Kamala Kapoor. Her book is The Privilege of Aging. And you make a statement in your book that I think some people would say, what does she mean by that? That's a little too far out there. But I have experienced it. You say that allies in the form of strangers are sent by the universe in our hour of need. And when I lost somebody close to me, I just took my car in to get the oil changed, And this kind man behind the counter, I was saying, well, he was telling me what was wrong with my car. And I was saying that, well, I've got to make the decisions myself now. I used to have somebody to consult. And this dear man took out his card. He wrote his phone number on a card. And he said, if you need something fixed, you call me. He was a stranger. I'd never seen him before in my life. And when you say these strangers can be allies sent by the universe in an hour of need. And why don't you give, I just gave an example in my own life, because there were others about that same time, like within days of each other, total strangers. But what in your life, how can you persuade somebody that you know what you're talking about when you say that, Kamala?
Well, you know, you do. I mean, the other day I went to an acupuncturist, for example, and this was, I was suffering from all of this, and he got my history, and then he said, you know, I can't treat you right now because you're following an allopathic model, and I don't think you should get acupuncture right now. It's too much for you. And he said the words, less is more.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know? And that has guided me all this time for 3 or 4 months. I say to myself, less is more. You know? Because in this culture, it's like more, 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 more. Oh, yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. And that was an eye-opener for me.
One thing that we want...
That's Lao Tzu.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, yeah. I'm quite a fan of the Tao Te Ching. Do you know one thing that you mentioned in your book talking about more is that when we have somebody close to us who is facing death, we want more. We want more time with that person. And you make the point in your book to celebrate the time you did have with this person and be grateful for what I've experienced rather than wanting more. And so I think that's something that is helpful for people to remind themselves.
You know, you have to take that further. And when we're in ill health or dying, we want more of life. Mm-hmm. We want more health. We want more youth, you know. And you really have to, I mean, what you're mentioning is gratitude.
Yes, yes. And in your book, too, here's a quote, I need a model of someone who died consciously, cheerfully, joyously. And that came home to me because when this person close to me died, I first wrote out notices to family members and just say he died at 2:38 in the morning. And then I realized, well, they would want to know that he died peacefully. So then I started adding, he died at such and such time, he died peacefully. And then I realized it was not only peacefully, he was actually happy. He died happily. And when you say this in your book, you want a model of somebody who died consciously, cheerfully, joyously. I wouldn't have, not too long ago, I thought, what does she mean? So have you found such a person who can help you be a model of dying consciously? For example, patient, your husband says one day, this is where I'd like to die.
Yeah.
And so I've sometimes been asking people lately to, if they could choose their circumstances, how would they choose to die?
Yes. And you know, I write a whole chapter on Socrates, who died happily, but closer to home, you know, my sister died 4 years ago, and the day she died, the night she died, all day she kept saying, all is well, all is good, all is good, all is well. You know, I say that to myself even while I'm living, and I'm not having a very good day, or I'm, you know, feeling a little down, I just, all is good, all is great, you know.
Yeah.
So, and my father, he said, when I die, I want it to be a celebration.
Well, Now, I have trouble with that because when somebody I love dies, I don't feel like celebrating. I feel like grieving.
I know. That and that point is well taken, you know. But after the period of grieving is over, we have to celebrate their life. We have to celebrate our own. You know, we can't, grieving is a very, very, very necessary process that we have to go through. We can't avoid it. We are human beings, you know. And then we have, while we are grieving, and we won't stop grieving till we see it in the light of gratitude that this person was a part of my life. I had so many years with him or her. And we had good times together. And
if they're in pain, you wouldn't want them to continue in pain.
No.
So it's their own benefit that they, they're no yes. longer in pain.
Yes.
Now, you do offer ways, I mentioned yoga that you use, being outdoors. And you also, your sentence, what a magnificent tool meditation is. And many, many years ago, I was on campus and saw signs for transcendental meditation, and I took the training, and I was a failure. I would sit there the prescribed time, but I had trouble doing nothing. And you said meditation is ultimately doing nothing. So how do you interest people who say, gosh, I've never meditated, Kamala. I don't know how to do that. What advice do you have for people who are in that situation?
Well, I think that my particular way, you know, you mentioned transcendental meditation. That's a fine way to begin. My definition of meditating is sitting, you know, and you're not doing nothing. You have made that active choice to sit in a position, hopefully that aligns, you know, that makes the axis of your body, which runs through the top of your scalp to, you know, to your sacrum, in a straight position, and you just sit, and you just sit. You can watch your breathing, or you could, you know, just start off with sitting. I'm going to sit for 2 minutes. You know, all of us have stopwatches, you know, and then you know, kind of go to 3 minutes to 4 minutes, and let whatever happens in those 3 minutes happen. Because the first thing you have to do with meditation is you have to notice how your mind works and how it works associatively. It jumps from one thing to another to another. And then if you have a mantra or a word that you focus on, and that's what, you know, professional meditators give you. I use my own. And so I, you know, you gently bring yourself back to that sound, which is a reminder for you to focus on that journey to nothingness. Because you probably know as a meditator and the others that meditate is that you get to a point where the brain just stops working and you're in pure bliss. And it doesn't always happen. So whatever happens in your meditation, don't whip yourself and say, this didn't happen, that didn't happen. You would have sat for 3 or 4 minutes, and that is accomplishment enough.
So if you were to, say, describe your book when we're wrapping up here, what would you like to leave listeners with?
I mention throughout, almost every chapter is structured around a topic. And so I take the reader through my story so that, because, you know, when you're preaching to people and telling them what to do, it just doesn't work. But telling them stories about yourself or about others, you know, there's something about stories that have a way, a direct way of impacting us. So I tell my own story, and then I evolve out of that. What in that story help me, and my hope is that it'll help the readers as well. We share life, we have experiences in common, and I think that we are all bonded and connected with each other, and we can learn from each other, just like I have learned from many others. And my hope is that this book will help people to negotiate their own lives, navigate their own lives in a way that makes it easier for them and happier.
Well, I want to thank you for writing this book, Kamala. Let me remind listeners again that the title of the book is The Privilege of Aging, Savoring the Fullness of Life, and the author is Kamala K. Kapoor. Thank you, Kamala.
Thank you, Nancy.
When I come back from a break, I'll be talking to Chico author Tara Mayer about her book, Farm Girl, Benzodiazepines and Antidepressants, What Your Doctor Didn't Say. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Soon after she graduated from the University of Kansas, Tara Major's doctor prescribed benzodiazepine for insomnia. Tara has now written the story of her personal journey of 3 decades of drug-induced health challenges. Tara Major wants to raise awareness regarding the long-term effects of antidepressant use. The title of her book is Farm Girl, Benzodiazepines and Antidepressants, What Your Doctor Didn't Say. And that's spelled Farm Girl, P-H-A-R-M. Tara Mayer, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy, and thank you for having me here.
Now, how soon after your doctor prescribed these medicines, how soon afterwards did you start feeling effects of that?
That's an interesting question because it was insidious. I would say after a few years, my sisters noted some behavioral changes. And as years went on, and there were 8 in all, where I took my prescription nightly as ordered, that my behavior became more and more erratic. Until, and maybe I can describe a few of those instances later, but after 8 years, I was advised to get off of them with no warning, either at the time of prescription or at the time of deprescription, of withdrawal and how horrific that could be and the far-reaching consequences of that situation.
So it took a few years. And maybe you didn't notice, maybe your friends and family noticed before you did that, hey, she's acting strange. Was that what happened?
Yes. Looking back, in hindsight, I can see that I started behaving in ways that were out of character for me. And I think after 7 years, I suddenly left a very good husband. Not maybe a year after that, I was... wound up talking some fellow into going to Central America with me. And I remember hiking down a path, following some Guatemalans and getting into a dugout boat and floating down a river and winding up in Honduras. And there's just one story after another like that in this book.
So once you recognize that you were doing things out of character for Tara Mayer, you decide, gosh, maybe I better get off these drugs.
Well, it didn't quite happen like that. It wasn't until I was in a situation where I didn't have them that I went into horrific withdrawal. I went to a doctor who then said, you better get off of these, and gave me four or five pills to taper over the course of 2 weeks. And at that time, I had no idea that the withdrawal could last so long, as in months to, I think the average is over a year for people who have problems with that.
Well, now, you were surprised yourself how long this took. But I think you make the point in your book that doctors themselves don't know about tapering off these drugs. Is that the case?
That is what I've found over and over again in my own experience, as well as the probably hundreds of stories I've heard, probably thousands online, where the tapering guidelines are not adequate for about 50% of people who are trying to get off antidepressants or benzodiazepines. But there's new information out, and I'd love to be able to share that.
So the doctors themselves don't know, because these guidelines are leading the doctors to believe something that's not actually the case.
Exactly. And so when people are in tolerance or withdrawal, they're getting diagnosed with other mental illnesses, another prescription is added. And oftentimes it's really just a pharmaceutically induced mental illness.
Well, let me tell people the name of your book again, because Farm Girl, Benzodiazepines and Antidepressants, What Your Doctor Didn't Say. So that sounds kind of like a criticism of doctors, but maybe they didn't know.
Exactly. I think doctors are wonderful and well-meaning, and the doctors I know well are shocked when I tell them my story and cannot believe how common it is. And so, you know, it's my duty to raise awareness and help as many people as I can.
Well, so then that makes us wonder, well, if doctors don't really know the whole story about these medications, maybe the pharmaceutical companies don't want them to know.
Well, I think that's true, because my research led me to find out that the pharmaceutical companies support the FDA. They're the primary source of money going into it. And that a lot of the educational conferences that doctors go to are, you know, five-star affairs that are put on by pharmaceutical companies with paid representatives. And as well as some of the research methods that provide the information people are given are shady at best.
Well, you discovered this, and it makes you wonder about a lot of things. Now, do you maybe suffered long-term damage of physical consequences of these benzodiazepines?
And antidepressants. But what happens when people are forced to taper off rapidly and their neuroreceptors aren't capable of adapting at the speed with which the drug is being removed, that causes withdrawal. But it can also cause, what I've read and been reading, is long-term neuroreceptor changes. And I believe that's what I experienced. I've had many, many successful years working as an occupational therapist in between.
And you're still practicing occupational therapist as a therapist?
No, my mother passed away last year, and I'd taken time off to take care of her. Mm-hmm. And now my focus has been on helping educate people who have information to bring to their doctors so that they can go through a kinder way of tapering off a medication.
So you suffered extreme withdrawal symptoms.
Extreme.
That must not be very common, because doctors must not be that familiar with it. Was your case an extreme case of withdrawal?
What I've read and the studies I've read, I think in a 500-person study of people coming off antidepressants, 50% rated the withdrawal as severe, And
50%.
It's around 50% of people who will have a lot of trouble coming off at the current rate that most doctors are telling their patients to get off.
Okay, well, let's say that I'm a doctor and I'm trying to help you taper off the drugs. And should I prescribe you some other drugs to help you taper off? What should I do? What would you ask me to do if I were your doctor in that situation?
If you were my doctor, I would say read the Maudsley deprescribing guidelines that just came out this year, written by Dr. Mark Horwitz, who's in a 5-year taper himself trying to come off of drugs after he's a psychiatrist and was unable to find a knowledgeable doctor to help him with this. A lot of times prescribing a different drug, which is what's done in rehab facilities, can replace one dependence for another. And the length of time it takes about half of people to come off is not something that can be covered by insurance in a rehab facility. So I would tell my doctor to let the person stabilize, hold the dose, give them a compounded liquid to taper at a rate that can often last 2 or 3 years.
My guest is Tara Mayer. She has written a book, Farm Girl, and it's spelled P-H-A-R-M, although on the cover of the book, I guess that's supposed to be you riding a horse.
It is so, me.
So that you're a farm girl in a couple of meanings. The subtitle is Benzodiazepines and Antidepressants, What Your Doctor Didn't Say. And you actually use your own name when you're telling this story. And I'm assuming some of the people that you write about, Tara, don't use my real name.
I didn't use the real name except for the few people who wanted me to. Yeah.
So would you read a little paragraph from your book? And you're telling this in, it's your story, you're telling it in the first person.
Writing this book required me to stand toe-to-toe with my shame and fear and illuminated a rage I did not know existed. Ultimately, I had to embrace the very things I sought so hard to avoid. But there was no question in my mind. More stories regarding a pharmaceutical epidemic of disastrous proportions need to be told.
So I'm assuming that's why you wrote this book, Tara.
It's a big piece of it is to educate people and to provide empathy with people who go through this. I also teach people how to calm the autonomic nervous system because the imbalance between excitatory neurotransmitters and calming transmitters that occur with withdrawal is a real thing. And so learning to calm the nervous system through vagus nerve stimulation and other autonomic nervous system calming strategies is a good thing.
Well, and I think if somebody were trying to taper, say I was on them and I said, okay, I'm gonna quit taking these drugs. But then the symptoms of trying to quit taking them were probably what I took the drug to begin with, insomnia. So if I'm trying to quit taking these drugs, I better not try cold turkey.
No, you better not try cold turkey because it will make it much, much worse. But I will say that from my own experience of having gone on a benzo for sleep and then later an antidepressant for sleep, now that I'm off all of it and I do some self-calming things, I sleep fine with nothing.
That's great news. I'm so glad to. This sounds like a story that has such a happy ending that people, even if I myself didn't, I might have a friend, and you're saying that readers, everybody can read this book and benefit from maybe being more sympathetic, as you said. So I think this is a book we'll all want to read.
Oh, thank you. And I'd like to say that family members could really learn a lot from it, too, because some of these symptoms are so far outside a person's frame of reference that it can be dismissed or thought
yeah,
of
just
as
get
your,
over
your,
it. Just, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot that family members could get from it as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for writing this book, Tara.
Thank you, Nancy.
Again, my guest has been Tara Mayer, and the title of her book is Farm Girl, Benzodiazepines and Antidepressants, What Your Doctor Didn't Say. I would also like to thank my first guest, Kamala Kapoor, whose book is The Privilege of Aging. And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Orchard Poem. How many poems do you want? Are left, are waiting to shine, fall around us, will spread out, take root, find home, wake up within, draw the sky, sleep in until, whisper I love you, remember your smile, sit in the quiet, and follow the dream to its end. There won't be any left when I'm done, out in the orchard. I will pick the trees of every one, from the high branches where I climb unsteady and scared, to even the overripe and soft on the ground, up from the frost to my cold hands, and put them in my shirt like a fat man's belly stretched and strained, back to the house, back to you. And in the stainless pantry sink, we will wash away the dirt and leaves, all the words that we don't say anymore, hold them up, to the window, to each other, bruises and wormholes, naked, shimmering, and pure again. Mike Waltz.
Ode to Chocolate. You've got to linger with dark chocolate. It's a waste if you chomp on it real fast. Thrust it to the back of your mouth, swirl it with spit, squeeze it down your throat. Then it will feel like melted wax, taste kind of like sugar, and, oh, nothing more. You'll think, huh? What was that? And walk away shrugging. No, concentrate. Bite little pieces thoughtfully. Swish them. You might notice cinnamon, nutmeg, vanilla beans, pepper, sweet thunderstorms on your tongue. Sometimes the soul needs chocolate when we're flung towards chaos and plagues. Bigots, wildfires, and powerful fools leap our way. Cacao lifts us up, unbinds our tongues, helps us stand on the speeding ground. Food of the gods, keep us wild. Paul Belts.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.